It's Wednesday, February the 10th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. We're going to be talking about loan sharks. Yes, they're out and about. Money Mail has found quite a few of them. The cladding scandal. Ministers have finally announced a financial scheme, but most people say it's not going anything like far enough. The exclusive interview in the Daily Mail today with Lady Britton, whose husband, the former Home Secretary, was wrongfully accused of being a murdering paedophile. I'll be talking to the journalist who's spoken to her. But first, Lord Sumption, former Supreme Court judge, on why the government's 10-year jail sentence for people who may fib about whether they've been on a red list country is completely ridiculous. The government is facing a growing backlash over the threat of a 10-year prison sentence if people have lied about visiting countries on the so-called red list of countries, which is all tied up with the government's anti-COVID strategy. The former Supreme Court Justice Lord Sumption argued in a powerful piece in The Telegraph that the term is extraordinarily high compared to other offences, and he suggested that the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, who's put this proposal forward in the Commons, possibly time he looked for a new job. I'm delighted to say Lord Sumption joins me now. You make the point, Lord Sumption, and it's a very powerful point, that we are saying that if somebody has been on a trip to Portugal, which is on the red list, and they may fib about that on their form when they come back, that's going to be put in the same level as an act of gross indecency, because that's what the sentence can be for gross indecency and other offences involving firearms, for instance.
Yes, or sexual interference with minors, which normally carries a sentence of 7 years maximum.
I talked to somebody close to Matt Hancock, and they said, look, he's got to send out a message that they're deadly, deadly serious about stopping people coming in from red list countries, to which I said, well, why didn't he do it a year ago then?
Well, first of all, I think the criminal justice system and penal policy is a very, very serious matter. It is not a platform for government rhetoric. And so to say Matt Hancock needed to do this in order to send out a message is a misuse of the criminal law. Secondly, you raised the question, why didn't the government do it a year ago or more? I think that is an interesting and important point. Experience suggests that if you are a relatively small island like New Zealand, or very small like the Isle of Man, you can, if you stop people coming in right at the outset, prevent COVID-19 ever taking root. I very much doubt whether that was ever a feasible policy for us. We are not a remote island. We are not, like New Zealand, 4,000 miles from the nearest major landmass. We are a country with an open society, open to the world, whose economy depends on international links to a quite remarkable degree. So I doubt whether this was ever a feasible option, even last January. Moreover, it is something that Sage consistently advised against right through the early months of the year until really quite recently. So that seems to me to be something which you can't criticize the government for. The problem now is that this is being justified as an attempt to keep out mutations. Now, the problem is, as the government acknowledges, viruses spontaneously mutate all the time. Some of these mutations will be harmless. Some of them will be harmful. Some of them may undermine the efficacy of the vaccine. But this is going to happen whatever the government does. We simply cannot go on indefinitely in this way. We have to recognize, as the government's scientific advisors are increasingly willing to recognize in their public statements, that we are not going to suppress COVID-19 entirely, even with the vaccine. Remember that it took 2 years after the development of a highly effective vaccine against smallpox. Sorry, two centuries after the development of a highly effective vaccine against smallpox to eradicate it entirely. We have to live with COVID-19 for the long term. And policies which can't work in the long term like this are, as it seems to me, a really serious failure of government.
And you actually, in your article, you say that ministers who only consider the positives of the term without considering the cons are unfit to hold office. And you say it's time for Hancock to be moved elsewhere.
Yes. I mean, this is nothing personal against Matt Hancock. But the problem is, he has been health secretary for 18 months. And for the last year or so, he has been concerned with pretty well nothing other than COVID. He's had his nose to the grindstone for a long time. And the problem about that, in the case of ministers, is it tends to give them tunnel vision. It tends to prevent them from looking at the broader effects of the decisions that they make. It has to be said that this government is very prone to that vice anyway. They persistently ask themselves no question other than, will this save deaths? They don't get the answer to that right most of the time, but it's the only question they ask, and it's not the only question that matters. Saving deaths is part of the issue. There are other issues involved which are at least as important, issues of social policy, educational policy, and economic policy. No country ever saved lives by making itself poorer, but that is what we are doing in spades at the moment.
Very interesting. And I'm intrigued here. We touched on this at the beginning of the interview, Lord Sumption. You do make the point, does the Health Secretary really think that non-disclosure of a visit to Portugal is worse than the large number of violent firearm offences or sexual offences involving minors, which the maximum is 7 years? Do you think they plucked the figure 10 years out of thin air?
I think they said to themselves, what will make a good headline? And that is not a proper way to approach serious issues of penal policy.
How much poorer do you think they are making the country?
Well, I honestly don't know what the answer to that question is, but clearly they are making it a good deal poorer, and quantification will no doubt have to follow much later. But nobody can doubt that the damage that is being done is very considerable, and moreover, that it is not falling equally on everybody. The economic damage that is being done primarily affects the younger generation. It affects people who are finding it more difficult to get qualifications because of the effect of lockdown on education. And above all, it affects people coming onto the job market or leaving school or university for the first time and finding, as they are finding, that there are no jobs. A world in which talented engineering graduates or musicians find themselves stacking supermarket shelves is really a world in which something has gone seriously wrong. And when it results from government policy, one has to question whether the government in question is capable of looking at the issue as a whole.
If I could ask you just finally, there was a spate of reports last week, the Chancellor sort of denied them, but suggesting that this has to positively be the very, very last lockdown, so that when we come out of it, God only knows when that will be, maybe April, maybe May, that's it. Do you agree with that?
Well, of course, yes. I think that we shouldn't be in the present lockdown. I think that the problem about all of these lockdowns, last year's one saved no lives at all because it simply pushed the deaths and the infections into a later period. There's a lot of controversy about whether lockdowns work anyway, but it's quite clear that they don't work unless you keep them in place indefinitely. And it seems to me that an indefinite lockdown, something that would have meant that we had been continuously locked down ever since last March, was simply intolerable and inhumane. We have to maintain some kind of sense of proportion in looking at even at the most serious crises. And the sense of proportion is what has sadly been lacking from beginning to end.
Indeed. That is the former Supreme Court Judge, Lord Sumption. Thanks for joining us. So in her first ever interview, Leon Britton's widow, Diana Britton, Lady Britton, has spoken out to attack a culture of cover-up at Scotland Yard. Her husband, who was, of course, the Conservative Home Secretary, was falsely accused of murder, rape and child abuse by a paedophile fantasist. Today, Lady Britton's told the Daily Mail of how she felt violated after having her home searched after the death of her husband, and she's attacked MPs who supported the false accusers, in particular the former Deputy Labour leader Tom Watson. I'm joined by Daily Mail crime writer Stephen Wright, who's made this story his own, who interviewed Lady Britton. Stephen, I've known Lady Britton for a long time. She's a very dignified, very measured woman, but she has taken her time in speaking out. But my word, she hasn't pulled her punches.
No, I mean, more than 5 years. She has really kept her silence. I mean, a couple of very brief soundbites to video interviews she's done before, but nothing like this. And you're right, she is a dignified lady. She doesn't want to rush into anything, evidenced by the fact she's waited 5 years to speak out fully. And she's not someone who courts controversy at all. But the purpose of her speaking out in the Mail is for there to be a full record about what happened to her late husband, what happened to her, and what happened to her daughters in this scandal. And also, in relation to the police investigation, the fact that not one officer has been held to account over this truly disgraceful investigation. Not one officer has been held to account, despite a High Court judge throwing the book at the Metropolitan Police and calling for five officers to be investigated for less alleged misconduct or even more serious offences. Not one officer held to account. In fact, nauseating, many people might regard it. They've all been either promoted, ennobled, or enriched.
Extraordinary. And she describes, it's very moving, the shattering impact, Stephen, of the police raids on her home in the aftermath of the death of her husband, and even digging, looking for a shallow grave in the garden.
Yeah, I mean, just to put things in context, her husband had been dead 6 weeks. He died following a battle with cancer in January 2015. The police turned up on March the 5th, 2015, 6 weeks later, at her home in Pimlico, and there was a coordinated raid up in Yorkshire at their country home. And they had what the judge who did the inquiry has labelled an unlawfully obtained search warrants, and they turned her home upside down. They even looked through condolence cards. She received hundreds from across the political spectrum. They looked through condolence cards from David Cameron, the then Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, the future Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, a former Prime Minister. They went through those looking for supposed evidence based on the unchallenged account of not a fantasist. I wouldn't call him a fantasist. That's too good for Carl Peach. He's a wicked liar. And they didn't challenge his account. They steamed in and to a house in Pimlico. Lady Britton had a friend with her for about an hour. I know who that individual is. I won't name her, but she is the wife of an appeal court judge and a magistrate herself. And she overheard one of the senior officers on the raid saying that Lady Britton hadn't had time to hide anything. Now, consider this. Lady Britton sat as a magistrate for 26 years. She is a former chairman of the National Lottery Community Fund. She has received a damehood and a CBE for her own achievements in life. She is a former Home Secretary's widow. She is proud of the fact that she has been a law-abiding citizen for 74 years then, and she was treated like a criminal. She says she was treated like a criminal.
And this also, Sir Edward Heath, the former Tory Prime Minister, Harvey Proctor, a former Tory MP, were also caught in this vicious net by the vicious liar, Carl Beach, known as Nick. What she also, Stephen, really, really gives it between the eyes to Tom Watson, who I've known for many years. He was the Labour deputy leader. He fueled this fantasy theories of Carl Beach. He raised it in the Commons, and she says what he did was unconscionable.
The phrase you use, despicable and cowardly, because Tom Watson's column in the Sunday Mirror accusing Leon Britton, Lord Britton, of being a paedophile was written, published 3 days after Lord Britton died. I said on my podcast 6-part podcast series, which is going out now, in relation to that column, Tom Watson didn't dance on the grave of Lord Britton, because Lord Britton hadn't even been buried when he did the most extraordinary character assassination imaginable, based on the word of Nick Carl Beach.
And finally, Stephen, the irony of it all, of course, Tom Watson didn't get into the House of Lords, although who knows, they might put him up again in the Labour Party. But Bernard Hogan Howe, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, is now Lord Hogan Howe and has got about 5 or 6 well-remunerated directorships and consultancies, doing very nicely out of the fact, even though he presided over, he was commissioner during probably one of the worst injustices that's been carried out in decades by Scotland Yard.
Yeah, I mean, he'll have to examine his conscience on that. He's quite a thick-skinned individual, in my experience. This whole issue of reward for failure in the Operation Midland Nick scandal is just, most frankly, it's nauseating, and for most people anyway. Lord Hogan Howe, as he is now, or Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, he announced his surprise retirement just a few weeks before Sir Richard Henrique's report came out, throwing the book at the Metropolitan Police over Operation Midland. In my opinion, he would not have survived that report. He jumped before he would have been pushed, or his job would have been untenable. Of course, he insisted, I remember at the time, at the press conference after the report came out, oh, this has nothing to do with Midland, but he wouldn't have survived that. I don't think he would have survived that. Lord Bramall, our greatest living war hero, was still alive and someone admired by Her Majesty the Queen and the Prince of Wales. Lord Hogan Howe wouldn't have survived that. We'll see whether other heads will roll over this scandal in due course.
Well, on that point, Stephen Wright will be revealing even more on this extraordinary investigation he's done into Operation Midland and the lying fantasist Nick Carl Beach. Well done, Stephen. Great story. And there's going to be more to come in the Daily Mail in the days ahead. And do listen to his podcast. It's terrific. It's on Mail Plus. So the Housing Secretary, Robert Jenrick, has announced a new £3.5 billion fund to fix dangerous cladding on high-rise buildings in England. That's so if they're over 18 metres tall. If they're under 18 metres tall, he's announcing loans for shorter buildings with maximum monthly repayments of £50 a month. There's already a backlash on the Tory backbenches, with many MPs saying what he's announced is not enough and more needs to be done. I'm joined now by Paul Afshar from the End Our Cladding Scandal campaign. Paul, 4 million people, would you say, are stuck in dangerous buildings, some of them facing bills of over £100,000?
Yes, and the sad truth, Andrew, is that I don't think anyone of us knows, not least the government, how many people are affected. 4 and 4.5 million is actually an estimate. The announcement today, the sad thing about it is that I think it will only cover a fraction of those people. Just to give you myself as a case study, I live in a flat in a 4-storey building. I will not receive a single penny from the government. In fact, I'll be forced to have to take out a very long-term loan to pay back the cost of removing quite possibly dangerous and flammable cladding from my building, which is a problem that I didn't cause in the first place. So unfortunately, today was not what we were expecting, and feels a little bit like a betrayal, I'm afraid to say, particularly when you had the Prime Minister standing up at the dispatch box last week promising us that no leaseholder would have to pay to make their homes safe. So today is disappointing news.
And that's the point, isn't it? It's not none of your fault. You bought these properties in good faith. This cladding problem came to light after the terrible Grenfell tragedy, disaster. How much responsibility, Paul, are the developers taking? How much are they writing a cheque to help out here at all?
It would appear that that is not the case. The government talked today about putting a levy on developers, which I have to say is a welcome step, but I don't think a step far enough, in the sense that you've had the largest developers in the UK have made, since the Grenfell Tower, around £10 billion in profits. Now, it's their right to make those problems, of course. But, you know, when you've caused a problem of this magnitude, a problem that's keeping people awake at night, it's only fair that you have to make a very sizable contribution towards fixing it. And the government's proposals today actually don't touch the sides when it comes to making the people who caused, the companies who caused the problem in the first place, actually stump up the cash to fix it.
And the minister seemed to be very proud of the fact that the maximum monthly repayments via the loans, which you may have to apply for, would be £50 a month. Well, that's £600 a year. How long are those loans going to be over? I mean, that's going to run into thousands and thousands of pounds, isn't it? And it also contradicts what the Prime Minister said very recently when he said no leaseholder will be out of pocket. Well, they clearly are going to be.
Precisely that. And that's why I think it is so disappointing and feels like a betrayal. I would urge the government to get out its civil service calculator and sort of perhaps do those calculations, because if I'm paying even £50 a month back, in order for me to pay a loan of £40,000, potentially more, to have dangerous cladding removed, even if it is on a low interest rate, will take years, absolutely years, certainly much longer than my mortgage term. So this is the thing which is very unclear from today's announcement. Yes, we're going to have to take out loans, and of course that goes against what the government itself promised only a week ago. But for how long? And will that loan... will that loan be sort of saddled around my neck as I move properties? Will it be a debt that haunts me for the next 30 years as I hopefully am able to sell this property eventually and move on? All of this is unclear, and I don't think today's announcement solves any of that uncertainty.
And just so people are clear, the loans will be for properties below 18 metres tall. Why have they reached the figure of 18 metres? What is significant about that, Paul? They've decided, the government, have they, that properties that are shorter than 18 metres tall are less at risk from the dangerous cladding? Is that the point?
It would seem to me, Andrew, to be a bit of an arbitrary benchmark that the government has set itself. There is no greater or less risk when it comes to flammable cladding of a building being 19 metres or a building being 17 metres. The risk is still there. The cladding is still flammable. So it's very unclear to me, and indeed to many leaseholders up and down the country, why the government has set this limit. And as you say, regardless of where the limit is, it doesn't benefit the majority of homeowners, many of whom will live in buildings under that cap. I think there's tens of thousands of buildings across the UK with cladding that are between 11 and 18 metres. I think the number is around 80,000 buildings. So when you think of all of the sort of people who live in those buildings, you're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who are still left out of pocket and unsatisfied.
Make a prediction, Paul. The minister will be back. This will not satisfy Tory backbenchers. I heard of one Tory MP had his head in his hand saying he can't believe the government has got this so spectacularly wrong. He's got thousands of leaseholders in his constituency. It's a marginal constituency. That could be the difference between them voting for him or somebody who says they're going to sort the leasehold problem out without a cost to the leaseholder.
I think that's absolutely right. Our campaign, End Our Cladding Scandal, conducted some research with Inside Housing, an industry publication. It was about 1,500 respondents. 40% of those respondents were Conservative voters. And 8 out of 10, so around 80%, said that the way the government has been handling the cladding issue would impact and influence the way that they decide to vote at the next general election. So you're exactly right. You know, this is not just an issue which affects inner cities. It's not just an issue which affects people in high-rise. This is an issue which affects millions of voters across the country. And as you say, hundreds of thousands of voters in the constituencies of many backbench Tory MPs who very bravely have been speaking out against this. And I would urge them and encourage them to continue doing so, because it's their voice, it's their protest in a way, which is forcing the government to move on this issue.
That's what I say. He'll be back. Mark my words. That's Paul Ashfar. He's from the End Our Cladding Scandal campaign. And I suspect we'll be talking to him pretty soon, too. Now, don't forget, you can visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to Andrew Pearce, the show, free, of course, and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. And don't forget, Stephen Wright's done an extraordinary podcast series on Operation Midland, the shambles. That was the police investigation into some of our leading public figures. Remember as well to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest sports news, and he got his prediction on the cricket absolutely spot on. An historic win in India. You said they'd do it, Matt, and it was a risk, wasn't it, by the captain, because he declared very late in the day, requiring India to pick up a huge score, but they skittled them out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he got criticism for that timing of that declaration. People said it was too late in the day, but it proved not to be. He proved to be absolutely correct, and the criticism was unfair because England won comfortably before tea yesterday in the first test. And yes, a stunning performance. You know, they played brilliantly from the first ball to the last. And the hero of the second India innings, from an England point of view, was the evergreen James Anderson, 38, who took three key wickets with some wonderful reverse swing bowling. Now, Anderson's long been hailed as, you know, England's greatest bowler, and he's but yet there's still some who questioned whether he could do it abroad, you know, because he can do it in England, as he's proved time and time again, on nice green wickets with cloud cover overhead where he swings the ball. But this was wonderful bowling in India, where it's very difficult for fast bowlers. You know, it's a spinner's paradise, but not a great place to get a quick bowler. And he bowled brilliantly and ripped the heart out of the Indian batting lineup and laid the platform for, as you say, a stunning victory.
Great stuff. And even I know who he is now, James Anderson.
I should hope so.
Yeah. I didn't know who he was before the podcast started. Let me tell you, Matt, I'd never heard of him. But, you know, you're educating me.
He's only been playing cricket for England for 20 years. So
I've never watched a cricket match, Matt, as you well know. But now, Manchester United, their supporters must be getting a bit anxious. They left it a bit late to beat West Ham.
They certainly did, yeah. FA Cup, they went into extra time last night before they beat West Ham 1-0. Not the greatest game, if I'm honest. It was a very subdued game. But Scott McTominay, who's quietly making a bit of a name for himself in the Manchester United midfield, popped up with the winner in the 97th minute. So, you know, job done for United. They're into the next round. Bit of a blow for West Ham and David Moyes, but they can concentrate on the league where they're doing very well and maybe even continue their push for European football next season. So, Scott McTominay, a good performance from him, and as I say, he's quietly making a name for himself in that Manchester United midfield, where he's almost becoming undroppable now.
And finally, Eddie Jones, who I know is the captain of England rugby team, he might drop Farrell, but I don't know who Farrell is, I'm afraid, Matt, so you have to explain.
Okay, well, Eddie Jones is the coach.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. That's fine.
I sort of knew what he meant, really. He's like the manager, isn't he?
Yeah, I know you thought of him. Yeah. And his captain is Owen Farrell. Now, Farrell's been heavily criticised for his performance in England's loss to Twickenham, in England's loss to Scotland at Twickenham on Saturday, where they were appalling. And a lot of the blame was laid at Farrell's doorstep for kicking the ball too often and missing the opportunity to pass and get the quick players and the backs and the wings involved in setting up some thrilling rugby. So he's been heavily criticised. But Eddie Jones was very quick to defend him yesterday, saying that his captain is outstanding, and dismissed basically any suggestion that Farrell won't be playing in the starting 15 this weekend when England take on Italy. Which means that all those crying out for change and for Ford to play, George Ford to play instead of Farrell, have been wasting their breath, because it seems Eddie Jones is not for turning. So we'll have to see. But the thing is, if England will beat Italy on Saturday, and Farrell may well play well, he may well, you know, kick his points, and he may well lead England to a comfortable victory, and maybe all this hoo-ha will be forgotten. But the next time they play someone decent again, you know, the spotlight will be back on Farrell. But, yeah, Eddie Jones, going to stick with him.
Right then, that's Matt Gatwood, who is, of course, the deputy sports editor of the Daily Mail. Great stuff, Matt. Speak soon, mate. Powerful stuff in the Money Mail pages today about amoral sharks preying on people facing financial difficulties caused by, guess what, the coronavirus crisis. This is an investigation by Money Mail, which shows there are imposter websites promising they can write off almost all your debt, and they use similar designs and logos as charities such as Citizens Advice and National Debt Line. And they claim, of course, that all their services are approved by the government. And of course, they're absolutely not. I'm joined now by Ben Wilkinson, deputy editor of Money Mail. Ben, how did you get onto this? Was this readers coming to you about the problem?
No, it wasn't actually. It was the regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority, published a big review last week into unsecured debt. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff about buy now, pay later products, which made all the headlines.
Yes, but, yes, that's right.
So within that report was this warning about debt advice and how it's basically open to mis-selling and kind of a warning of, you know, what is to come with, you know, so many people needing debt advice for the first time, yet they're so vulnerable to being ripped off.
And so people are seeing these websites, which appear to be Salvation Help. What are they being offered by these websites, apart from advice? Are they being offered money to get them out of debt?
No, so what it is it's they usually start with this attractive kind of promise of, you know, we'll wipe off 80%, 90% of your debt. And these are through agreements that are known as IBAs, and they basically, an insolvency practitioner will strike this agreement with you and your creditors. And it will be, you know, you pay a certain amount a month for 6 years or so, and then the rest of your debt's written off. Now, for the creditor, that's much better than you going bankrupt and then not getting anything. But the insolvency practitioner will make a lot of money from striking that deal. And if, for some reason, you can't keep up with the payments, then, you know, it's void and your debt still stands. You might have to pay interest, and all the money you've spent on fees is of course, wasted.
Oh dear!
So people are, you know, the big risk. People, if you know, if it's not a suitable product for them, then you know, it could push them further into debt.
And this position has been exacerbated, Ben, by COVID. A lot of people not working. Maybe they're on furlough, or they've not got as much money, or maybe they're some of these self-employed people who are hardly getting any money at all out of the government.
Yeah, that's right. The watchdog, the Financial Conduct Authority, says. I think it's estimated up to 1.5 million more people this year could need debt advice. And these are people who've, you know, perfectly responsible with their money, you know, always saved, always never overspent. But just because of the extreme situation we've had, they're facing debt for the first time.
And the advice Money Mail gives, of course, Ben, is be wary of these people. It's all, if you've got problems, go to reputable organisations like Citizens Advice or the National Debt Line.
Yeah, that's it. There is free help available, and you know, if one of these IBAs is the right thing for you, then you know, the worry is they're being oversold, so they will be alright for, you know, a limited amount of people. But don't just go online and go to a, you know, some random company to set you up with one of these. Go to one of these charities that offer, you know, impartial free advice. I think Step Change is a really good one. Step Change Debt Charity, Citizen Advice, or National Debt Line.
Really, it's just fine, Ben. It's really sinister, isn't it, that some of these websites that promise they can write off all this debt, they're using similar designs and logos as charities to sort of lull people into a false sense of security.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's exactly what they're doing. And it is, I mean, it's astonishing they can get away with it, to be honest. But and they're also drowning out these charities on Google search results as well. So you type in help with debt and you don't get the free advice that, you know, is available. You get a whole load of companies that, you know, want the best for them rather than you.
Very interesting. That's Ben Wilkinson, deputy editor of Money Mail. Do read the stuff today. It's fascinating. And if you have got debt problems, as Ben says, go to the reputable places. You can't go far wrong with Citizens Advice. That's for sure. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I am Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening, and good night.